här är internationell författarscen och jag heter Athena Farrokhzad.
Och jag heter Ida Linde och vi är programansvariga för litteraturen här på Kulturhuset Stadsteatern.
Alldeles strax ska ni få höra författaren Georgi Gaspadinov i samtal med Ulf Karl-Olof Nilsson.
Varmt välkomna! När jag hittade Gostan och kliniken hade jag just börjat skriva på en roman om det förflutnas diskreta monster. Dess förrädiska oskuld och vad som skulle hända om vi började återkalla det förflutna i terapeutiskt syfte. Sysslorna på kliniken och det parallella skrivandet av boken var som två kommunicerande kärl. Ibland tappade jag greppet om vad som var verkligt och inte. Fragment från det ena gled in i det andra. Hur som helst handlade den viktigaste frågan i bägge fallen om hur förfluten tid skapas. Ska det komma någon som han, som kommer att förbarma sig över dess livlösa lemmar, bleka ansikte och stilla stående hjärta och säga: Lazarus, kom ut. Och det förflutna får sakta men säkert tillbaka andan. Blodet flödar under vaxhuden. Lämmarna sätts i rörelse. Öronen fälls ut och ögonen öppnas. Eller, medan vi väntar, kommer diverse falska profeter, frästare och galna doktorer att göra experiment på det förflutnas lik. Och varje gång slutar det med Frankensteins monster. Kan det förflutna bli återupplivat eller uppfunnet på nytt? Och bör man verkligen? Och hur mycket förflutet klarar en människa egentligen av? Välkomna till internationell författarscen. Jag heter Ida Linde och är programansvarig för litteraturen här på Kulturhuset Stadsteatern tillsammans med Athena Farrokhzad. Boken jag just läste ur heter Tidstillflykt och är skriven av Georgi Gaspadinov i en alldeles fantastisk översättning av Hanna Sandborg. Den är utgiven på Ersats förlag. Och det här samtalet som ni har sett fram emot och som jag har länge har sett fram emot kommer att pågå i ungefär en timme. Och efter det så kan man gå ut i foyer 3, så finns det möjlighet att köpa boken och få den signerad. Men nu så ska vi inte behöva vänta längre. För i samtal med ingen mindre än Ulf Karl-Olof Nilsson. Welcome on stage, Georgi Gaspadinov.
Hej, hörs vi? Can you hear us? Very good. I want to start with a famous quotation from Confessions by Saint Augustine, that is Augustinus in Swedish, that goes something like this: I know very well what time is, but if someone asks me what time is, I do not know. So, dear audience, if you think that you understand what time is, now you will most likely know less about it after this conversation. Because we're going to talk about time and memory and nostalgia, and we're going to do that in the best of company with the Bulgarian writer Georgi Gaspadinov. But first I will have a short introduction. Georgi Gospodinov is a writer of many genres. His first book were poetry collections published in the 90s. And since then he has published short stories, but also librettos, essays, screenplays, and he is a columnist for one of Bulgaria's daily newspapers. Gospodinov became internationally acclaimed for his novels. The first one is called Natural Novel, published 1999, and is translated to, I think, 23 languages. His next novel, The Physics of Sorrow, won the Bulgarian National Award for Best Novel of the Year in 2013 and is also translated into multiple languages. And the latest novel, Time Shelter, published in Bulgarian in 2020, won the Strega European Prize, that is Italy's most prestigious literary award, and the English translation of the book by Angela Rodel won the International Booker Prize in 2023. So today we shall talk about Time Shelter, just released in Swedish as Tidstillflykt, translated, excellently translated by Hanna Sandborg on Ersats förlag. Welcome to Sweden and Stockholm, Mr. Gospodinov. Time Shelter is a brilliant and rich novel, so full of ideas and surprising moments. Although it is not a normal novel, it's full of different small genres, micro essays, lists, almost poetry. Nevertheless, it has a distinct plot, and I would like to ask you if you could sort of walk us through it.
Okay, good evening first, and I don't see anything, but I suppose that there are people in the room, that we are not alone with you. Thank you that you are here, and thank you that you said that it's not a normal novel. It's true, it's not a normal novel. I don't believe that normal novels exist anymore. Or what I consider as a normal novel is a novel written by a normal person, but normal persons is someone who is thinking not like trains going from point A to point B. We never think like this. Mm. And when I start to write my novels or my short stories, I always try to use the structure of my thinking and my thinking, and like everyone's thinking. We don't think in one genre. No. Our days are not in one genre. Mm. We change genres in our days, in our thinking. Every hour. And that's why this novel, actually this novel has much more plot than my first novel, natural novel. And what about the plot? Shortly, it's about a strange flaneur Gaustin, my friend, the friend of the narrator, which had this crazy idea to make clinic for the past, and which is very, very good idea. I still think that it's a good idea. In this clinic for the past, it's for patients with dementia, with Alzheimer. So they could go into the rooms of the past, the room from 1950s, 1960s, or 1970s. And these rooms, in details, they are dedicated to the decades of 50s, 60s, 70s, with the smell, with music, with furniture, with everything. Because when we start losing our memory, we are going back into our youth, and if in our bodies, in our mind, we already lived in 1968. Mm-hmm. We should feel synchrony with the environment around us, with the rooms around us. So this was the idea. After that, Agustin decided that he could build the floors of the past and then the districts of the past, and the idea was more and more successful. And many healthy people without dementia who just want to live in the past, who just want to spend one afternoon in 1973. They started to enter into this clinics, district, cities. And after that, the idea was weaponized by the politicians. So that's why at the end of the book, or the second part of the book, we have referendums for the past. Yeah. And every country decided to choose the happiest decade in this referendum for the past. Yeah. And in these referendums, we have two kinds of countries. One of them, like Sweden, for Swedish people, it's very difficult to choose the happiest decade of 20th century because they have a lot of happiest decades. But for Romania or Bulgaria people, it's also difficult to choose the happiest decade for the contrary reason. And that's about the book.
So the ID expands. How did you get the idea of writing this book? How did it start?
15, 16 years ago, it described in the book, actually, and it's absolutely true. 15, 16 years ago, I bought a newspaper, Augustin. This is a newspaper made from homeless people, for homeless people in Austria. I bought this because I have a special, I really obsessed with the homelessness.
Yes.
I think that all of us are on the edge of the homelessness. Mm-hmm. And I bought this newspaper and I read a small article, really small, like notes, about a doctor, a psychiatrist, who realized that when patients came to his office, and his office was designed in the late 50s, he was a big fan of Elvis Presley, when patients came to his office with dementia, they started laughing, or they became more talkative, and they remember, they start to talk stories about their past. And that was the idea that maybe there's something here. And that's why it came to my mind, and I started to think of what about if we made the whole clinics for these patients and if they start to live there, not just to visit, like in the museum, to live there. And what about if the healthy people come there? And what about if we had the whole districts? What about if we have this safe time and space? And so on and so on. And after that, I forgot the idea. I wrote down in my notebook and I forgot it. And many years later, I know especially when, in 2016, when some political things happened, Trump was elected, we had Brexit and so on. We had populism arise. And then I decided that it's a time to write about this idea, but I knew that it will be never so innocent. I mean, this coming back to the past will be never innocent because it became a kind of propaganda. You know, Joseph Brodsky, one of my favorite poets, he says something like this, that the future is propaganda. And it was true. In our communist time, the future was a propaganda. They always promised us future, a lot of future. And it never happened, of course. But now we could say that the past also could be propaganda.
Absolutely, yes, the past is well. If I may read a quote here, it has to do something with that, I think. I mean, in the novel there are Gaustin's texts and notes and books, which are cited from time to time. And one text has this intriguing name, New and Imminent Diagnosis. And one diagnosis is called Collective Amnesia and the Overproduction of Memory. And it is described as the following. I quote, "The more a society forgets, the more someone produces, sells, and fills the freed-up niches with ersatz memory, the light industry of memory, the past made from materials, plastic memory, as if spit out by a 3D printer." Do you think that memory has collapsed today? And at the same time, is there an over-exploitation of memory?
Yeah, both. Maybe.
How can we see that?
Both. I think we never had so many information, light industry of memory.
Yeah.
But also never we had this condition of fast oblivion. And I think we are in something like a memory gap now, in these years, because, you know, the people who remember one of the most important events in 20th century, like the Second World War, now they passing away, they disappeared. The other problem is that we think that memories, it's like for granted. Once we had the memory about the war, about the crisis, it's enough. We no need to talk about this anymore. But the problem is that memory is something very alive, and you should tell your stories every day to keep memory alive. And the other problem with the memory and with the oblivion is, first, literally, the society growing old, and we will face more and more with the problem of Alzheimer, with the problem of dementia. It's one of the, fast developing
diagnosis. Illness. Absolutely, yes.
This is very important because it's really a problem. It will be a problem. But also, we have something like a social Alzheimer, collective Alzheimer. With the new media, with everything, with the new information, we forget more and more. because I like to, I'm on the side of the books and literature and reading, and I always, maybe it's naive, but I think that reading books is something that really could develop memory, not like scrolling on the phones or scrolling on the tablets. Yeah. It's completely different exercise. and reading of the books is a slow act.
Yes.
But this is produce long-term memory, which.
I was in Amsterdam last week, and I went to the Rijksmuseum, and I saw Vermeer, paintings by Vermeer. You know, everybody, I mean, including me, was taking pictures of the paintings and of themselves. And I think it's a good example of the overproduction of memory and collective amnesia. I mean, we just do that not to remember.
I think that
we have the memory in the phone.
I have a poem. We finish with this: that when we die, maybe we will watch photographs, our selfies, all the time, because we produce so many selfies that we will not have time till we are alive to watch them. I think we keep them for for another time.
Was I really alive? Yes, I must have been. I mean, it's a very important thing that when you quote Brodsky here, that the past is propaganda, and the book has this nationalist But for example, when the referendum in your home country, in the chapter called One Nation Taken as an Example, I think, and you describe this, the two parties fighting for power, which has their own sort of nationalistic agenda. Can you tell us about
that? Yeah, this is... I started Novel because, not only because PAS is dangerous like it itself, but PAS is past is very important for the nationalism. Mm. You know, the nationalism built its ideology on the past. It feeds it feeds with the past in a way. Mm. Make America great again. We should be great again. Hungary should be great again. Bulgaria should be on the three seas. We have this idea. Mm. And that's why the past could be dangerous. And this nationalistic kitsch is something that I really wanted to write about this, to describe this. Mm. Because it happens and it will happen more and more. Now, when we walked with my publisher, we crossed the royal court, I think, no, the parliament, in front of the parliament. Mm. And he told me that in the beginning of parliament session and the last year or the last years, some of the deputies of the Democrats, nationalistic party.
No, Swedish Democrats.
Yeah, they started to dress in the folklore. Dress. And I wrote about this in the novel. I think I invented this in my novel, that all deputies will go with the folklore customs.
Yes, yes.
But, you know, it happens. And I'm sure that it will happen more and more.
Yes,
and
yes.
That maybe, as it's written here, one day, if you see someone dressed like you or like me, it will be very strange. But, and maybe dangerous.
Maybe dangerous, yes, yes.
So this is about the chapter, of course. The chapter about Bulgaria is a bit longer. But also, I wrote chapters about maybe 17 of European countries.
Yes, yes.
And it was one of the... it was not easy to write... And to guess what kind of nostalgia, what will be the happiest decade for, let's say, for France, for Italy, for Sweden, for other countries. Because, it's not easy to predict nostalgia of the other nations, of the other people abroad. It's not easy to predict nostalgia even for your own country. But anyway, it's easier then to know about the other countries. So that's why I started to make a search about the history. I read a lot about the history, the economics, politics of the countries, European countries.
Popular culture.
This was much more important. I talk with people from these countries, with my translators also. But I realized that sometimes the irrational things or the things that are not connected with the industry and politics are also important. And sometimes they are even much more important. Yeah. So the legend that you had about your past, the legend for the 1960s, 1970s, sometimes are much more important. And people could vote for these decades from when they were young. Mm. And when they considered life for the better life. So I made my suggestion in the book. You could see if they are right or not.
You even made a map?
Yeah, I made a map, but this is a time map. Because the idea of this book is that sometimes, or not sometimes, but now or in a close future, the time will be much more important than the space.
Exactly. It's a sort of a replacement, substitution.
It's a replacement, the time will replace the place.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way. Because the space is, how to say, after Colomb and after traveling with airplanes and so on and so on, the place is it's easier to reach the place. We traveled a lot, we know the world map and so on. But more and more we start to look for different times, much more than for different places. It's a strange process. I think that it's connected with nostalgia.
Yes.
I think that now our nostalgia is a bit different. We have nostalgia not for the nostos, not for the places, but nostalgia for the different times.
Nostalgia is pain, isn't it?
Yeah. I could tell it's a chronostalgia.
Chronostalgia, yes.
Because you know that nostalgia is connected with algos, pain to the home, to the nostos. But this home, our homes don't exist anymore.
In a way.
We even if you come back to the places where you had your childhood, where you were born, I tried this. There is nothing there. Because the time changed. The place is the same, but the place is defined from the time. And I think that we will think about this in the terms of time.
I mean, the neologism, I think, chronostalgia is a perfect example of when time replaces the place.
Yeah.
I would like because this has to do with Bulgaria. I would like to quote here again. Happy countries are all alike. Each unhappy country is unhappy in its own way, as has been written.
They
recognize Tolstoy here.
This
is a great audience.
After that, we will have lamps here. I will see.
And here you make use of the first sentence.
I want to say something. Of happiness and unhappiness. Sometimes, or even often, I think that unhappiness is much more important for the nation consolidation, in a way. And in Bulgaria, because we have one revolt. Against the Ottoman Empire in 1876, Aprilsko vstanie, April revolt. It was unsuccessful revolt.
Yeah.
But I think this is one of the most important historical events in our history.
Yeah.
For good and bad. Every year we make a big reenactment, detailed reenactment of this unhappy revolt. And we consolidate around this. Sometimes I must say these reenactments are a bit kitschy. They're too detailed. And I think that one day maybe the reenactment will be so successful that the unsuccessful April revolt we'll finish like a successful one.
They will
change the history with making this reenactment. This book is also ironic to the reenactments because I think that we had different attitudes to the past, and one of them is to reenact the past just to build artificial model of the past. And for me, much more important is the other attitude to the past, to think about this, to read about this, to go deep into the past, and so on and so on. So this book is a bit against the easy reenactment of the past.
It is, yes. But you also make a connection between the unhappy and the unhappened.
Unhappened, yeah.
Unhappened, which
it's a wrong etymology, I know, in English. But look, what is the unhappened and unhappy, unhappened and unhappy are connected in some ways. I think that, and this is a topic of all of my books, that in our part of the world, we had a lot of unhappened things. This is our treasure, let's say. Mm. A lot of unhappened things. And this unhappened things, it's not easy to tell stories about something that never happened. But I think it's much more important to tell stories about the unhappened things because they shaped us, they define us much more than the happened things. Mm. And for me, this is very interesting. So I like to write about the denied world.
Yeah.
You know, that 80% of Bulgarians never left their country for the 20th century. Mm. 80%. No, maybe for the second half of 20th century, after 1944.
Wow.
We were not allowed to travel abroad, I mean, in the Western countries.
Mm.
But that's why there are generations that invented this unhappened world for them. My parents, they didn't travel actually abroad in this period. And when I travel after that with my books, I always call them. I always watch with their eyes.
Yeah.
And this is different. This is different way of visiting some country abroad. It's a kind of compensation. Even I think that for myself, I travel a bit more than it's needed, because it was a value. It was a real value in the time when your parents or your grandparents were not allowed to travel. Mm. So it's a kind of compensation on my side.
You traveled for them.
This is very, very... I think this is very important topic. It's connected with the feeling that life is somewhere else. Mm. That you are not in the world in a way. And I like this quotation by Montaigne. He says, I don't have any interest to visit India. But if somebody forbidden me to visit India, I will be unhappiest person in the world.
In the book, at least in the first part of the book, there are like case studies, small case studies, and which are also connected to Bulgaria, and in that sense, this case about, I think, Mircea. I mean, it's a perfect example of exactly that the unhappened is what is left in memory. Yes. And it's also, it pinpoints the very, very thin line between fantasy and memory.
Yes, it's about the Mircea from Turnu Mureș. It's Romania.
It's Romania.
Yeah,
okay. Okay.
Like Bulgarian, we always have a bit of irony to our neighbors, but they also have to us.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's about the Mircea from Turnu Mureș. The story shortly is like this. The case is like this. Mircea worked all of his life in the factory, in the communist factory. And when he started to lose his memory, the only thing that he remembered was the unhappened thing. All of his life, working in this factory, he dreamed to visit a concert in Central Park, to live in New York, to visit these open-air concerts in the 60s of Central Park. I forgot which concert exactly, if you remember.
Paul Simon and Garfunkel, perhaps. No? Yes.
Yeah.
I think so.
thank you. And this was actually the last thing and the only thing that he remembered from his life. Because sometimes we remember not the things that happened to us, but the things that we dreamed a lot about them.
Yes.
And I'm sure for this. I'm sure that also you could confirm this. Sometimes we have memories from the books that we read, and they're so alive, like the real memories. I started to smoke cigarettes because of the Erich Maria Remarque. Do you remember Erich Maria Remarque? Because all the soldiers, they smoked these heavy gitans in the tranchees, and they drank Calvados. Calvados sounds so strange, so magic for me. Once when I tried it, I realized that this is apple schnapps, but... But look, Calvados, I invented this memory. Calvados. And so I remember this is part of my life. Also part of my life is the beginning of the 100 years of solitude. You remember this beautiful beginning of Bymarke's novel that one day when Colonel Aureliano Buendia stays in front of the soldiers. He remind about the afternoon when he was child and his grandfather took him to see the gypsies and the ice that they bring. And so for me, this is like my grandfather. I think that I have memory about this. And this is very important. Books created memory. Reading, that's why reading is important, because reading creates memory. And these memories are so real, like the real ones.
Yes. I think that one of the wonders in with the book is that, I mean, it's describing something that I presume that we all know something about. We have all our time shelters. They are sort of everywhere. If we start to look, we have our playlists and our favorite recipes that can follow us through our lives, but it takes a very normal experience and sort of enlarge it and takes it to the extreme and takes it from the personal to the nation. And if the first part has its case studies. I mean, in the second part, there are also case studies about the countries. For example, we are in Stockholm. How did you work on Sweden's referendum? I guess you wonder what year we chose. Georgi will tell us and why. I hope.
In the part about Sweden, I checked this part yesterday because, it's a novel about Alzheimer. I also have this fear that I forgot names and everything. And actually, there are some very important sentences for the novel written in exactly in this part about Sweden. And I couldn't find them. I couldn't read in Sweden. But one of them was about this, that when people make choices, that sometimes people are tired from for the good life, with the industry, with the Volvo, with the refrigerators, with the many of these things. And sometimes things from their everyday life, like ABBA, or the chair Poang, am I pronounced correctly?
One more time.
But Poang chair, this famous chair, like... Poang, okay, yeah, sorry. This one, or maybe even IKEA, I don't know. These things are also very important. We shouldn't underestimate them when we should choose our happiest decade. These things, I think, turned down the referendum in Sweden because most of the Swedish voters, in my novel, they expected that late 50s, will be happiest decade when Sweden stayed very good, very well in the post-war Europe. But I don't know. I suggested 70s. We will see. And the referendum in the novel should be in 2029. So if you have a referendum in 2029, tell me, I will follow what we will choose.
I mean, you foresaw I lost the word. You foresaw a lot. Let's say that. Speaking of memory loss, there is a extreme hilarious episode about when the narrator in the book forgets a name that is his ex-wife's name.
Yeah, when he gave autographs.
When you guess.
So yes. Please tell me your name properly when I gave autographs after this. Yeah, this is the personal fears. Actually, it's almost true story. It wasn't my ex-wife. it was a very good friend that I forgot his name, her name. And I was I feel so bad. And I decided to write something general without them, like about the past that we were together or something like this. And she turned me back the book and told me, please put the name there. And it was really, really terrible. And no help from anyone. And then, because I was so felt so awkward that I put my hand very heavily on the glass of the
glass table.
And I broke the glass, and I had here blood, and it was really a shy situation. But it helps me. She didn't ask me anymore about to put the name. It was so personal to have blood on the on the cover of her book.
We'll do anything to cover up
bloody autographs. But I think this is there are different level of amnesia, you know. Of course, it's one of the fear I think of every one of us, because it's terrible when you start to lose your memory. You're losing your life. You're losing your past. You're losing your identity. You're losing your wife and your families. Because you forgot them. This is really terrible. But the amnesia is not only so funny like this story, but sometimes it's connected with the body memory. When we reach the last stages of the amnesia, people forget how to swallow, how to eat, how to move. Even our movements are a question of memory. The body remember, the body has internal memory. And so that's why this topic is really, really big and serious topic.
It's also true that it often starts with the name.
I mean,
the names. Mm-hmm. I mean, who doesn't, we all experience that. We just try to talk about the film, a movie with a movie star and forget the name. And then I would guess that you would probably not forget a preposition under, on, with. You would probably not, at least in the first, not forget a pronoun. And then it sort of trickles down, perhaps. But I in the book, the narrator, I think the narrator also starts to forget. No, someone starts to forget letters.
Yeah.
The letters sort of evade.
I just imagine this. When you start to forget letters and the letter disappeared like from the books, like small insects.
Like insects crawling away.
who are going out from the books. But this is your book. It's full of inscriptions.
I have read it.
And I like inscriptions, by the way, mentioning this. You know, was the one of the problems when you start to write new book is that you start to write your book in the already written field. there are a lot of books also about dementia, about Alzheimer, about memory, about everything. I think that memory is the topic of the last 10 years, maybe. And then what you could do is to... When I wrote this book, I wrote in solitude, of course. I was alone, but I had this feeling that I'm in conversations with other books, with other yes. authors, and this is very, it was very, very good, very important feeling. For me, for this book, I must admit some other books that were very important for me, like The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann.
Ah, yeah.
Great book and philosophy and everything. Also, of course, Borges. I like very much Borges. He had one short story, Funes de Memorias, about the man who could remember, who remember everything, every detail, and it actually was a problem. He didn't have imagination, because our imagination is needed of empty spaces in the memory. That's why the oblivion, it's not only a bad thing. We need a kind of dementia to start to reinvent what we don't remember anymore. Also, other books, the poetry of Winston Hugh Oden was important, Oden, and especially one poem, because the book is it's also about the book. It's a book about the 1st of September 1939, and you know this famous poem by Oden. September 1st, 1939. It starts like this. I sit in one of the dives of 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid. And this uncertainty of 1939, I think that we repeated it. We have it again in late, in 2020s, let's say.
We must love each other or die.
We must love. This is the final line of the poem. We must love each other or die. Oden didn't like it, and he always removed from the poem. And in the book, because we talk about the music, I tried to connect this line with the Doors song. You remember Alabama song? It finished like, I tell you, we must die. I tell you, the we must Weil, die. So for me, it's a conversation between Doors, Oden, but also Kurt Weill, who first invented this song. Anyway, when we talk about memory and when we write novels about memory, it's very important to keep this net, these connections with other things. So you could see how in this line, we must love one another or die. You could hear Kurt Weill and Brecht from 20s and Doors from 60s. And everything is, in a way, it's a long conversation between books, between poems. So that's why in the book there are a lot of conversation with other authors. Also a lot of music.
Music and smell.
And smell, because, the narrator is a collector of smells, because smell is one of the big triggers of our memory.
Isn't it something about the narrative that sort of has something to do with the fly?
Fly appears.
There is an episode also with a fly traveling in an airplane.
Flying the airplane. Actually, it's from a kind Zurich. Of auto quotation because fly was very important in my first novel, in my short stories. Yeah. Why flies? Even I have a graphic novel, The Eternal Fly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm. Why fly is important? Because it's not eternal. Because fly is everything that is not monumental, that is anti-monumental in a way, that is perishable, easy dying. And I did a lot of research about the domestic fly. And I think,
in a way, the fly is opposite to the bee.
Sorry?
It's the opposite to the bee.
It's opposite to the bee, yeah? In the communist ideologies, ideologies don't like flies, don't like bees, because
they like bees.
Bees make homes, make honey, they work like a collective. The flies don't have collectives. Flies are anarchistic creatures. No, but that's why I like them. Because nobody likes them. And somebody should love them. And also, yeah, the flies, no, it's a very serious topic about the flies. Flies are anti, they are anti-monumental, I said, but they're also anti-anthropocentrical. We live in a world that is anthropocentric world, and we are on the top of the everything, which works against us now. But it's good if you could put yourself into the fly to feel that you are perishable, that you are like fly also among the other creatures of the world. And one example, it's in the book, but for someone who didn't read the book, would you know which is the first, okay, you know, which is the first creature in the space? It's not like the dog, it's not monkeys. It's the domestic fly, not domestic, but fruitful fly. Yeah, and it happens in 1946, 47, when the first rockets reach the space, 100 kilometers from here, and they used, the scientists used this fruitful fly because of the shortened life that they have, because they needed for 2 hours to watch the process, the processes that happened into the organism of the fly. So sometimes the easy dying is a quality.
Mm-hmm. But you don't like endings.
Why? I'm not good with
endings. You're against endings.
Yeah, I'm against endings. And
it's a difficult thing to avoid.
One of the last sentences in the novel is that in the world and in the novels, the endings should be postponed. You know, the answer of this question is in my first novel, Natural Novel. It was a novel only from the beginnings, because, as character said, I want to live in the novels on the first 17 pages in the novel, when every family is happy, nobody is divorced, nobody is dying on the first 17 pages. So that's why, the character in this my first novel wanted to live in the beginnings. No, I don't like the endings because, no, the endings are too pathetic in a way. You should say something, your last words. I like the idea that we should start again and again.
I mean, and in a way, the book, with all its this collage and these different genres and this, it's restarting many, many times. And although at the same time, it has this overall plot that sort of holds the parts together.
Yeah. Look, why? Because this is a book about memory, but also The Physics of Sorrow had the similar structure, my previous novel. In Physics of Sorrow, I used time capsule. Here, I'm using time shelter. Why? Because all our books are time shelters in a way. In a personal way, if I should explain why I needed a different genre, a small everyday stories inside. On the one side, it's because it works against the oblivion. It's a kind of therapy. Telling our personal stories is a kind of therapy against Alzheimer's and dementia. But there is also something else. I think that I will be happy not if my books will be read after 100 years, because I'm not sure if the people will understand what happened here. I will be happy if the generation of my daughter keep the memory about my books, about the world we used to live. And I believe in this short-term future and short-term past, let's say in this warm future and warm past, human-sized future and human-sized past. Because I don't like abstract ideological thinking about the, I don't know how we will live in the space and we will invade it, Mars, Jupiter, I don't know. No, I don't like to fly to the moon and to live to the moon. I want to have one generation behind me and one generation in front of me and all of us, at least for this three generation, to talk to each other, to know our memories, to have common memories. This is important because when people start to losing their common memories, the talk is not possible anymore. And in a way, that's why now we have this problem all over the world. The talk is broken between us. The conversation is broken in a way.
It is, yes.
In a way, we, yeah.
If I remember right, Borges says that a human being dies three times. First, when your body dies the first time. The second time you die is when nobody remembers you anymore. And the third and final time, that is when there is absolutely no trace on Earth, either in the memory or in any physical sense.
There is a scene in the book when the narrator and his father, who is suffering from dementia, his father is dying, and the narrator is thinking, if the last person who remember me as a child die, did I exist and do I exist anymore? Is my childhood exist anymore? Because he was the last evidence that I was a child.
Yes, yes. Perhaps we should end this conversation, it's inevitable, by reading. Or do you want to tell a story? You said that you wanted to finish with a story.
We talked before that if the conversation get more deeper, deep and dark, I will tell a story about the Bulgarian sorrow and Bulgarian irony.
Let's say
it's a real story. When I was a child, I had a huge headache, and I was 6 years old. I used to live with my grandmother. She was 93, and I started crying in the night. I will die! I will die! And she started to console me in this way. Don't cry, my boy. You will not die now. First, I will die. Then your grandparents will die. Then your father and mother will die. And then you will die. And I started crying even a lot, but this was the Bulgarian way of consolation. And yeah. And there is a logic in this. There is a right order.
Yes. Hopefully it will end like that.
Okay,
we should read the two last parts of the novel. I'll read in Swedish first. 47. Det här är sista minnet, the last memory. 47. 47. Jag är nog tre. Lång som rosorna i trädgården står jag barfota på den varma jorden. Håller mamma i handen och stirrar länge på en ros. Det är det enda jag minns. Det första och det sista.
47. Трябва да съм на три. Висок колкото розите в градината. Стоя бос върху топлата пръст. Държа майка си за ръката и гледам дълго една роза в упор. Това е единственото, което си спомням. Първото и последното.
48. Bristande tillhörighetssyndromet ur Gaustans nya och kommande diagnoser. Ingen tid tillhör dig. Ingen plats är din. Det du söker, söker inte dig. Det du drömmer inte om dig. Du vet att någonting var ditt på en annan plats och i en annan tid. Därför fortsätter du att kryssa runt i förflutna rum och dagar. Men om du befinner dig på rätt plats är tiden en annan. Om du befinner dig i rätt tid är platsen annorlunda. Det är obotligt.
Синдромна непринадлежащите. Никое време не ти принадлежи, никое място не е твое. Това, което търсиш, не търси теб. Онова, което сънуваш, не те сънува. Знаеш, че нещо е било твое на друго място и в друго време, затова все прекосяваш минали стаи и дни. Ако си на вярното място, времето е друго. Ако си във вярното време, мястото е различно. Не е лечимо.
Thank you.